Good evening, church. It's good to see all of you this evening. And I want to again extend my gratitude for being able to come before you and present some lessons from God's Word. I really do enjoy presenting lessons from God's Word. And I think I have a tendency to call everything my favorite. Because if it's your favorite, then you want to go for it. And, so I have a lot of favorites, and I don't see anything wrong with having a lot of favorites. But one of my favorite things to do is to study, Bible characters, because I'm just fascinated with people. And, these people that we have recorded in the Bible, though they lived thousands and thousands of years ago, they still speak to us as real people through the ages and teach us something about God that I just find really extraordinary. The Hebrews author, after he goes through this whole list of the heroes of faith in chapter 11, in 12 he says, "So then, with such a great cloud of witnesses, let us run our race." So these people that are recorded for us in the Bible, in the Old and the New Testament, are really this cloud of witnesses that we can look at and say, here are examples of people who made it. Here are examples of people who found a real and unique and lasting relationship with God. And they have already run the race. And these stories here are really those stories to encourage us to continue on our own race and our own journey with God. When you look at this, just a cursory glance at the Bible, sometimes you can be left with an impression that God only works in big and huge and grand, miraculous ways. And it seems like a majority of the characters, if you just go through the Bible, and as I mentioned, you look in Hebrews 11 and look at the people that the Hebrews author tends to look at, the majority of these people seem to be really big, larger than life characters, like Moses or Joshua, or their kings like Solomon or David, or their prophets like Elijah or Elisha, who performed these amazing miracles. And you go into the New Testament, and not only do you have stories of Jesus, the Son of God, but you also have later, you have stories about Peter and Paul and all the places that they traveled and all the different hardships that they faced as they tried to proclaim the way. And there's just as you go through the Bible, you have all these big, expansive, influential people with big, huge, amazing, and sometimes miraculous things happening to them and with them. And we might get in our mind that that's only where God is concerned, in the big, huge things. And it's only in those big events that God is primarily concerned with and operates in our human existence. And as I mentioned, one of these great men, Elijah the prophet, I mean, you can just have this whole laundry list of all of the great miracles that Elijah performed while he was around. He's just one amazing, miraculous encounter with God after the other. First, he told King Ahab that it wasn't going to rain until he said it was going to rain, and it didn't rain for 3 years. And during that 3-year period, Elijah was fed by ravens, and then he went to a widow and he stayed with this widow, and there was a never-ending supply of oil and flour while he stayed with them. And then he raised her dead son up from the grave. And then after 3 years, he challenged the prophets of Baal to essentially a god-off. And he said, okay, you guys, you build an altar, make everything ready, and then you call out to Baal, and I'll build my altar, and I'll prepare my offering, and I'll call out to the Lord, and we'll see whose God answers. And And after an entire day of the prophets of Baal praying and pleading and cutting themselves, Baal failed to answer his prophets. And then Elijah had his altar built. And not only that, he had a trench built around the altar. And he had the offering on the altar, and then he had water poured over the altar so that everything was drenched and the trench was full. And then he prayed, and fire came down from heaven, consuming not only the offering, but the altar and the water as well. And then after his defeat of the prophets of Baal, Elijah prayed, and it finally rained after 3 years. And not only that, Elijah ran from atop Mount Carmel down to the city of Jezreel and beat Ahab, who had a head start in a chariot. Amazing, big, miraculous things. And that's only the beginning of Elijah's story. It goes all the way till he's taken up into heaven in a fiery chariot. But Elijah, after a bout of depression, is taken by God to a mountain called Horeb, and he's told to wait for God to pass by. And if you would turn to 1 Kings chapter 19. So I just want you, I brought all those things up to just, so you realize all these great things that Elijah has done through the power of God. Our first recorded resurrection from the dead in the Bible, of fire coming down from heaven, all these amazing things that Elijah did through the power of God. And now Elijah, in this moment of weakness and depression and kind of, Elijah's burnt out, he's taken to Mount Horeb. And he's told that God is going to pass by. And it says in verse 11 of 1 Kings 19, "So he said, 'Go forth and stand on the mountain before the Lord. And behold, the Lord was passing by. And a great and strong wind was rending the mountains and breaking in pieces the rocks before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind. And after the wind, an earthquake. But the Lord was not in the earthquake. After the earthquake, a fire, but the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, a sound of a gentle blowing.'" Or some versions say a still small voice or a whisper. So I want you to think about this. Elijah's told God's going to come pass by. He's on this mountain, and this huge wind that's so powerful that it causes rocks and boulders to crumble off of the mountainside, and God's not there. And there's this huge earthquake, and God's not there. And there's this blazing fire that sweeps over the mountain, and God's not in that either. But it's the sound of a still small voice. There's been a lot of discussion about what the Hebrew actually means that's translated as still small voice, which kind of lends to why a lot of the different translations choose a slightly different look at it. And some people believe that the way that it's worded in the Hebrew is that it's not even describing a sound at all. Or it's describing a sound that's not even perceptible to human ears. Some translators translate the still small voice as the sound of sheer silence. God isn't just the God of big, huge, amazing, loud things. And God isn't just the God of kings and prophets and generals. But God is also the God of small, seemingly insignificant things. And God is a God of the silence in between sounds. God is also the God of the seemingly insignificant people. He's the God of the day laborer. He's the God of the housewife. He's the God of the orphaned. And he's the God of the widows. And so it's with this in mind that I want to shift from Elijah to the story of a widow who in her own life was just trying to get by day to day. And she never experienced any big, miraculous, extraordinary events in her life. She just found a new husband and found a new life. God provided for her just as much, and maybe even more, than he does for the big important people. And that woman we're going to look at is Ruth. And if you would turn to the book of Ruth, and let's consider her for the rest of this evening. I love the book of Ruth for a lot of different reasons. But I especially like the idea that in between the stories of Moses and Joshua and the judges, and in between the story of Samuel and Saul and David and Solomon, and then we get into the prophets like Elijah, in between all of these huge, larger-than-life characters, there's this short, small, almost quaint story of how a widow finds love, just right in between, wedged in between all of these huge, important men. And so Ruth is a story about a widow who moves to Israel with her mother-in-law, finds a good man who marries her, and she lives happily ever after. I think most of us here have probably read through Ruth several times, and I'm not going to give an exhaustive look at the story and the narrative of Ruth. I'm going to assume that you know most of what happens in it, and so that we can get some get some lessons from this. But let's go ahead and sum up kind of who Ruth was. Ruth was not one of the children of Israel. Ruth was a Moabitess. She was a Gentile who married an Israelite who was living in the land of Moab because Israel at the time was going through a famine. So Ruth happened to marry an Israelite while he was living in the land of Moab. But Ruth's husband died, and so did his brother, who also married a Moabitess. His brother died. Ruth's brother-in-law died, and so did Ruth's father-in-law, who died, which left Naomi, the mother-in-law, who was an Israelite, and her two Moabitess daughters-in-law. In Ruth chapter 1 and verse 8, it says, "And Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, 'Go return each of you to her mother's house. May the Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. May the Lord grant that you may find rest, each in the house of her husband.' Then she kissed them, and they lifted up their voices and wept. And they said to her, 'No, but we will surely return with you and to your people.' But Naomi said, 'Return, my daughters, why should you go with me? Have I yet sons in my womb that they may be your husbands? Return, my daughters. Go, for I am too old to have a husband. If I said I have hope, if I should even have a husband tonight and also bear sons, would you therefore wait until they were grown old? Would you therefore refrain from marrying? No, my daughters, for it is harder for me than for you, for the hand of the Lord has gone forth against me.' And they lifted up their voices and wept again, and Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her. And she said, 'Behold, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and her gods. Return after your sister-in-law.' But Ruth said, 'Do not urge me to leave you or turn back from following you, for where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die. There I will be buried. Thus may the Lord do to me, and worse, if anything but death parts you from me.' And she saw that she was determined to go with her, and she said no more to her. So they both went until they came to Bethlehem. And when they had come to Bethlehem, all the city was stirred because of them, and the women said, 'Is this Naomi? And we'll go ahead and stop there. Whatever it was about Naomi, and it seemed to be that Naomi was a very good influence on her daughters-in-law, because at first both daughters-in-law want to go with Naomi back to Israel. But after a little convincing, Orpha returns back to her people in Moab, but Ruth refuses to leave. Whatever it was about her mother-in-law, Ruth saw her future tied not only with her mother-in-law, but with the land of her mother-in-law and the God of her mother-in-law. And I don't think, maybe we don't think of how momentous and how important this decision that Ruth made was, and appreciate just the gravity of Ruth's decision. Ruth gave up her homeland and the gods and the religion that she grew up with, the land of her father. And Naomi says, return to your mother's household. So maybe Ruth's father was gone. But what, regardless, Ruth had a family in Moab that Naomi was certain they could have found her another husband right away, and Ruth would have been taken care of, and Ruth would have been in a land that she knew, that she grew up in, that she was comfortable with, that she understood, and she would also be able to find financial and familial security. But what Ruth decided to do was to go to a land and a people that were not her own, adopt a religion that denied the power of the gods of her homeland, and living with another widow with no man in the household to help them in a culture that didn't always treat unattached women the way that they probably should have been treated. And so without a man in their household of Naomi and Ruth to assert his protection over them, and with no real means of income or financial security, Ruth was really walking into not a lot, at least by human standards, at least by our standards. If we were just judging based upon what seems like the smarter choice, it would have definitely been what Naomi told her daughters-in-law to do. Go back home, find husbands in Moab, and live out the rest of your life. But Ruth gave up the easier path. And she decided to take the path of her mother-in-law. The path that, for whatever reason, she knew was better. Somewhere in her heart, even though it didn't make sense financially, even though it wouldn't have made sense to her own family in Moab, even though it was more difficult, Ruth knew that that was the better decision. So again, let's review. Ruth is a Moabitess, a Gentile living in Israel, living as an immigrant, an alien. Ruth is a widow with no man to stand up for her in a society that didn't have many safeguards and protections for an unattached woman. But Ruth placed her faith in the God of Israel, the God of her mother-in-law, and God provided for her in various and sundry ways, I guess is a way to put it. First, God provided for Ruth through provisions in the law of Moses. And now, when you go through the book of Ruth, there's no point where it says, God came down and did this. Or it doesn't even say that God's Spirit came into somebody and caused them to do this, as it does in the book of Judges, or it does in other places in the Bible. There is no direct communication of God coming down and doing something, and moving something miraculously in this world. But God did provide for Ruth, and first he provided for Ruth in provisions in the law of Moses that he had provided Moses generations before Ruth was ever born. God established provisions in the law of Moses to help take care of the poor and the disenfranchised. Not to, and not to even mention also the various laws that God says be kind to the alien in your land, and to do and specific protections about aliens living within Israel, but also provisions for the poor. Ruth was able to glean from the fields of other people, even though she did not have any income and she didn't have a farm of her own. In Israel, according to the law of Moses, farmers had to leave the corners of their field unharvested so that those who were poor and could not support themselves could go to those corners of those fields and gather wheat for themselves to provide for themselves. This was God's welfare program in ancient Israel. And so God provided a way for Ruth not only to provide for herself, but Ruth went into the fields to also not only pick for herself, but pick for grain for her mother-in-law, Naomi. So God provided, through the law of Moses, God provided for Ruth. And sometimes we don't really think about that. What the things that God has set up already before we even came onto the scene that makes for life easier. We'll talk about how some of these apply to us more, but I want you to think about that. But even though there were provisions in the law of Moses, this was still a dangerous proposition for Ruth to go out into fields and gather wheat. In Ruth chapter 2 and verse 8, after Boaz notices Ruth, Ruth is gathering wheat in his field. Boaz wants to talk to Ruth, and in verse 8 it says, Boaz said to Ruth, "Listen carefully, my daughter. Do not go to glean in another field. Furthermore, do not go on from this one, but stay here with my maids. Let your eyes be on the field which they reap, and go after them. Indeed, I have commanded the servants not to touch you. When you are thirsty, go to the water jars and drink from where the servants draw." And she fell on her face, bowing to the ground, and said, "Why have I found favor in the sight that you should take notice on me, since I am a foreigner?" The part that I want us to really focus on right now is just because the law of Moses provided for poor people and provided for the aliens and provided in some sense at least some things for unattached women like Ruth, it doesn't mean that everybody in Israel followed it. And Boaz was aware of that. And so Ruth as an unattached woman would have been a possible target for someone with bad intentions. So God not only provided for Ruth through the law of Moses, but God provided for Ruth in another way. And we saw this in our reading as Boaz warned her about the possible dangers that she would face. Boaz then said, "You stay with my maids. I've commanded everybody not to mess with you, and you stay in my field, and everything will be all right as long as you do." So God provided for Ruth by providing godly people into Ruth's life, like Boaz. I want to talk a little bit about Boaz in a little bit later, but first, it's Naomi that comes up. Naomi, not only, as we saw in chapter 1, Naomi had a profound impact on Ruth, so much that Ruth was willing to leave her homeland to go to Naomi's. But Naomi, throughout the book of Ruth, gives Ruth wisdom and advice in what to do concerning gleaning, gathering together wheat, and also later on in the book of Ruth in what Ruth should do in order to propose to Boaz, and the propriety that Ruth should take, and all these other things. Naomi is constantly giving Ruth advice. And it's through God's provision of having Naomi in Ruth's life, and also Ruth being wise enough herself to take Naomi's advice and follow it, that Ruth really ends up far better than she could have been if she hadn't had a Naomi. But also, Boaz notices how much Ruth took care of Naomi. Boaz Boaz didn't just do this for every woman that came to glean from his fields. I'm sure Boaz, it seems like Boaz was probably a very generous man and very kind man and wasn't, and probably didn't turn anybody away, but he took particular notice on Ruth. Look at in verse 10 when Ruth said, "Why have I found favor in your sight that you take notice on me since I'm a foreigner?" Boaz replied to her, "All that you have done for your mother-in-law after the death of your husband has been fully reported to me, and how you left your father and your mother and the land of your birth and came to a people that you did not previously know. May the Lord reward your work and your wages be full from the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to seek refuge." Boaz not only makes sure that that Ruth is taken care of while she's gathering in his field, and not only, and as we look later on, Boaz, when she proposes that he marry her, he goes through all the legal formalities to ensure everything goes according to the law, goes to the closer kinsman redeemer, make sure that he doesn't want to marry Ruth first, and make sure that all the elders of the town see that that everything was done correctly. Boaz not only does all of that for Ruth, but the notice that Boaz gave Ruth and all this special treatment that he gave Ruth, especially at the beginning, was because of him seeing how much she cared for Naomi, and he was conscious of her own propriety as well. If you would look at 3 verse 10. "Then he said, 'May you be blessed of the Lord, my daughter.'" This is after she comes to propose and she lays at his feet. He says, "May you be blessed of the Lord, my daughter. You have shown your last kindness to be better than the first, by not going after young men, whether poor or rich." Here, these godly people that Ruth comes into contact also are there as a result of Ruth's own godliness. God, and this is the third part. God provides for Ruth through Ruth living out a godly life herself. Boaz not only protects her, but eventually marries her not because he had pity on her, but because he saw how godly a woman she was. Boaz mentions here in verse 10, Ruth did not just run after any other man, even though she was young. Apparently she was pretty enough that she probably could have gotten any man that she wanted, but she not only didn't run off after other men, but she took care of her mother-in-law, followed the customs of a strange land, and put her faith in the God of Israel. And it was that devotion of Ruth's, more than anything, the devotion to do what was right, that ensured that Ruth's story ended happily ever after. So let's take those three things and now apply it to ourselves. How God provides for us in the same ways that he provided for Ruth. Even though we might not experience like the big, grand, miraculous things that I had mentioned before that we see so much through the Bible, God does provide for us in very many ways. First, he provides for us through his word that he has given to us. There are all sorts of commands in God's word, like love your neighbor as yourself, or build others up in love. And just all these different things, to be kind, to be patient, to be gentle. And when other people follow out God's law to us, that is in a way God providing for us. When we're in need, when we need love, when we need building up, and there is somebody out there who follows God's law and does that for us, provides for us when we're in need, picks us up when we fall down. In a way, that is God providing for us through his law, through the words that he wrote thousands of years ago through the pens of inspired men. But as I mentioned that right there, it's not only the words that God provides, that provides for us, but the people who we interact with, God provides for us through. Christianity is a lot about a personal relationship with God, that we each are individually His children. As Paul also says, work out your own salvation. There's an element to Christianity that's just about my relationship with God and God's relationship with me. But Christianity is also about our relationship with each other. If I have a personal relationship with God, if I love God, if God has adopted me as His child, and you have a relationship with God, and God has adopted you as His child, then we automatically have a relationship as children of God with each other. So there are various ways that this provision that God provides for us through each other manifests itself. Isaiah says, as iron sharpens iron, so too do we help each other. We help each other to grow. In the book of Titus, Paul tells Titus to have the older women teach the younger women various things. And then the implication is also that the older men should also be an example to the younger men. But this is important for us to consider. For those of us who are both older and for those of us who are younger. For those of us who are older, it's to realize that you have a responsibility to the younger generation to teach them the things that you learn. And sometimes the things that you learn the hard way, so maybe they won't make the same mistakes that you do. Give them the advice and the wisdom that comes through age that they don't have on their own. But also equally important, just as Ruth gleaned all the wisdom from Naomi, from an older woman to her, Ruth also had the responsibility to then use that wisdom and follow that wisdom. So those of us who are the younger generation, it's important for us not to spurn the older generation and instead take their advice and the teaching of the older generation. Just because they're older and they're not hip doesn't mean that they don't have a lot of great things to teach us. And I know when I was a teenager, I knew that they didn't have anything to teach us. And now that I'm in my 20s, I'm trying to soak up as much as I possibly can. It's amazing how less than 10 years can dramatically change your whole perspective on people. But so what Ruth followed her mother-in-law's advice. And it was good advice that Naomi gave. If we are of the older generation, we need to focus on giving good advice to the younger people. And if we're of the younger generation, we need to start listening to the older generation. Because in that way, God provides for all of us through our interactions with each other. And not only that, God provides for us when we follow Him. There's a reason why God tells us that there are some things that are right for us to do, which is where the word righteous comes from. The right way, doing things the right way, and why God says some things are wrong for us to do, or sinful. God didn't just put up a dartboard with all possible human interactions and just throw them at them randomly and say, okay, it's bad to do this and it's good to do this. God didn't arbitrarily decide what was righteous and what was sinful. God tells us what is righteous and what is sinful because of whether it is good for us as human beings to do it or whether it is bad for us as human beings to do it. If you would turn to Romans chapter 6, but keep your finger in Ruth. We're going to go back to Ruth again, but Romans chapter 6. And verse 16. The end of verse 16 Well, actually, I'll go ahead and just read the whole verse. Do you not know that when you present yourselves to someone as slaves for obedience, you are slaves of the one whom you obey? Oh, yeah. Either of sin resulting in death or of obedience resulting in righteousness. Here Paul is saying, you know, you have to be slave to something. You, as a person, you make a choice. You either make the choice to do the right thing or the wrong thing. And in that sense, you are a slave either to whatever you do. If you choose to do the right thing, you're a slave to what happens, the results that happen from that. If you do the wrong thing, you are a slave to that. And there are two choices that we have. Either we obey sin and it results in death, or we obey, it's obedience, which results in righteousness, which later on Paul goes on to say is life. So Paul is basically speaking of the natural consequences of our actions. God, the right things for us to do are the things that lead to life, the things that lead to prosperity, the things that when Jesus said, I came to give you life so that you could live abundantly. It's advantageous for us in the long run to follow the righteous path. But that doesn't mean, even though it's advantageous for us, it doesn't mean that it's not always the easy path. Like Ruth. The righteous path sometimes looks harder, especially at the beginning, to the easy, sinful path. But in the end, because Ruth stuck it out, because Ruth stayed with God and trusted in Him, her story ended happily ever after. But that's not the end of the story. And actually, it would be perfectly fine if I could just stop the sermon right here, and we're not going to go much farther, but I could stop the sermon right here and say, Ruth turns out well because she had faith in God, and this is also why we should have faith in God and why we should stick it out, even if it seems hard right now. But there's something more about Ruth. She's married. At the end, she's provided for. Naomi's happy because Naomi has grandchildren, and which are Ruth's children. And it's a wonderful end to this great story. But Ruth was the great-grandmother of someone very important that comes a little bit later. In Ruth chapter 4 and verse 17. Oh, not in the right book. Ruth 4 and 17, it says, the neighbor women gave him a name, saying, a son has been born to Naomi. So they named him Obed, and he is the father of Jesse, the father of David. David's line, Ruth was the great-grandmother of a boy who would later become the greatest king of Israel, David. And David's line was perpetuated throughout the entire existence of the nation of Judah for several hundred years. And eventually through that line, the Savior of the world, Jesus Christ, would be born. And in Matthew 1 and verse 5, Ruth is mentioned in that line of succession from Abraham all the way to Jesus. So it's important to note that what on the surface might seem like just a quaint love story about an insignificant woman in the midst of these grand, great stories of prophets and kings, what seems to be a moment of silence in between incredible, miraculous movements of history was one of the most essential building blocks in the Bible. Without Ruth, without this quaint little love story, We wouldn't have David, and we wouldn't have Jesus. So the last lesson I want us to learn is never consider your part in God's plan as insignificant. None of us can see what impact the seemingly insignificant events in our lives God has planned to affect the generations to come after us. And it does not matter how small a thing is, God can use it for great things on into eternity. And I want to leave that thought with you this evening. We always encourage, if there's anybody who wants to become a Christian, give your life to Jesus. There's no better time than right now. Or if you need the prayers of the congregation, or if we can help you in any way on your spiritual walk with God, please let us know and come forward as we stand and sing.